Very few people are here today because I'm not sure if I know what I'm going to be talking about today. So last week we began discussing Rambam's view on Hashgacha. And we saw a number of things. First of all, we saw there are more copies if anyone needs. We saw Rambam's position that the appropriate way to respond to impending disaster or a situation of danger is through doing tshuva and appreciating that it's coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We saw that in the Rambam and Hilchos Taniyos with respect to national impending tragedies, as well as other places with respect to personal ones. I want to add one makor to that, which is in your source sheets. All the sources that I gave you today in the supplemental sheet are in the big packets. It's just that I'm going to be bouncing around, so I thought it would be easier this way. I assume everybody read. If you didn't, make sure you do so after today, at least if you want to understand this stuff. Maybe you shouldn't read it. It's up to you. But in Mor Nevuchim, from your source books, chapters 317, 318, 323, and 351. So those four chapters in Mor Nevuchim. So anyway, so as I said, but these are, the supplemental one should be easier. So just the first source on the supplemental sheet, which is an expression of the Rambam's theory, but this time in describing his own life. So the Rambam here, this is from a letter, and he's describing the harrowing voyage from Spain to Eretz Yisrael. So again, first source on today's sheets. On Motzei Shabbos, I set out to sea. On the Shabbos, the 10th of Iyar, in the year 4925, to creation, a great wave almost drowned us, and the sea was raging. I took a vow that on these days I would fast and conduct myself as on a full-fledged communal fast, myself, my family, and my entire household. And I will instruct my children to do the same until the end of generations. And to, I don't know if anyone is a descendant of the Rambam who's still keeping this tinus, but anyway. And to give charity in accordance with their abilities. My vow included that I would sit in seclusion on the 10th of Iyar. I would not see anybody, but rather I would pray and read all day to myself. Just as on that day, as I found nobody but the Holy One, blessed be He, so will I not see anybody or sit with Him, unless I am compelled to do so. On Motzei Shabbos, the 3rd of Sivan, I safely disembarked in Accra, and I was saved from persecution, and we reached Eretz Yisrael. That day I vowed to be a day of gladness and joy, fasting and presents for the poor, for me and my family, until the end of all generations. So the Rambam here, as we would expect from what we saw last time, attributes the danger that he was in, as well as the salvation that he experienced, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And as such, he took a neder on that day, on the day that he was in danger, that for his whole life it would be a fast day and a day devoted to contemplation, and likewise a day of celebration, a Purim Katan as it were, for the rest of his life to commemorate the day of salvation. One of the interesting things to remember is, despite all the things that we're going to see in the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim today and the like, one of the things that you always find when the Rambam's describing his personal life is he's very frum. That's not to say he's from in what we're about to say here, but I think it's important to keep it in mind. Okay, so two introductions. I don't think I'm going to have time for questions today, but after class, a lot to do. I want to not leave you with too many cliffhangers, I hope. So I guess it's only 8:20, so I assume the clock is wrong. Anyway, so, a couple of points. First of all, why is it important to study any of this? So, the Rambam clearly felt that understanding Hashgacha is both important and impossible. Impossible, take a look at the next source from section 1, chapter 72, the governance and the providence of him may be exalted, accompany the world as a whole in such a way that the manner and the true reality of this accompaniment are hidden from us. The faculties of human beings are inadequate to understand this. So first of all, the Rambam tells us that we may try to understand the nature of Hashgacha, but we'll fail, because as human beings, we're incapable of fully understanding it. Nevertheless, the Rambam devotes a lot of time, as you already read, explaining his, I guess, limited understanding of what Hashgacha is. And we'll see today, he's going to disclose to us extraordinary speculations that led to divine secrets, things that came to him through something similar to prophetic revelation. So the Rambam gets very excited about Hashgacha. As I said, he spends many chapters discussing it. He thinks it's extremely important. And in coming weeks, we'll have a chance to discuss other views of Hashgacha, perhaps more mainstream. I think it's important to understand the Rambam, A, because it's the Rambam, but B, because you'll hear a lot of different theories about what the Rambam actually holds, very much one differing from the other, min ha-katzeh la-katzeh, and therefore it's worthwhile to at least try our best to understand what the Rambam is saying. The Rambam writes that why is it so important to understand the nature of Hashgacha? This is the next source. This is from 354, so the very, very end of Mor Nevuchim. Im ken ha-kavana asher zachra b'zeh pasuk. The pasuk he's referring to is from Yirmiyah, quoted below. Hu biuro sheshlemus ha'adam asher bo yisalal be'emes hu lehagia el hasagas Hashem kefi hayecholas. The ultimate shlemus is to get to an understanding of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the extent possible, right? The pasuk says ki im bezos yisalal ha'mishalal, after saying what you shouldn't take glory in, this is what you should. Haskel v'yadoa osi, knowing HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ki ani Hashem osa chesed mishpat utzdaka ba'aretz ki vayla chafatzim Hashem. So to know now, so what does he say? V'ladas hashgachaso bevruav behamtio osam vehanhigu osam echi v'laleches acharei ha'asaga ha'hi bedrachim sheyischaven bahem tamid lasos chesed umishpat utzdaka lihidamos bepeulos Hashem. So we have a job. This pasuk is referring to our mitzvah v'halachta bedrachav, to try to imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Rambam says that to imitate HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ideally, a person has to understand his hashgacha and the nature of his hashgacha. And so understanding Hashgacha is a central principle. And that's why the Rambam stresses it so much. Right? V'laleches acharei ha'asagah ha'hi. After understanding HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his Hashgacha, to follow that, the like. And that's why the Pasuk says stress is baretz. Okay. Now, one last point. The Rambam is going to present a number of positions on, one last introductory point before we start, a number of positions on Hashgacha, most of which he'll reject. And, of course, the one that the Rambam, I guess, most significantly rejects is that of Aristotle. And before reading it, it's important to note the implications of Aristotle's theory concerning the eternity of matter. We refer to this briefly in the first semester, but we'll see it again insofar as it relates to us. The Rambam writes that if you accepted Aristotle, again, this is the next source, in such relation to the universe that he cannot change anything. If Aristotle's right, then God cannot have any effect on the world. If he wished to make the wing of a fly shorter or to reduce the number of legs of a worm by one, he could not accomplish it. Later, the Rambam writes, the belief in the eternity, the way Aristotle sees it, that is the belief according to which the world exists in virtue of necessity, that no nature changes at all, and that the customary course of events cannot be modified with regard to anything, destroys the law in its principle. This is why, as we saw, the Rambam says that we have to reject Aristotle's position, not because of the text of the Torah, but because his position totally undermines the principles of the Torah. And of course, the Ramban stresses this in last week's Parsha. So we're Yotzei the Ramban. We'll have weeks on Ramban, Sashkacha, don't worry. I know. Okay, so now, as I said, so in 317, hopefully you read it, the Rambam presents five positions on Hashgacha. He begins with the view of Epicurus, who was the Greek philosopher who lived in 4th century before the Common Era. And this view is basically that God created the world but left it alone and doesn't in any way interact with it. This is sometimes known as deism. He has no interest, no connection to the world post-creation. Now, obviously, this view is counter to the Torah. It's not surprising that Chazal termed the word heresy apikorsos after Epicurus, because it's the ultimate apikorsos. Though, interestingly, Rambam in the Pirush Mishnah says the word apikorsos comes from hefker. It's not the source. But anyway, that's opinion number one, clearly and obviously wrong. Opinion number two is that of Aristotle. And Aristotle maintained that there's only general and not individual providence. Meaning to say, well, at least in the sublunar world, in the celestial realms there is hashgacha, but in the our world, in the sublunar world, there is no hashgacha pratis. So everything that happens to human beings is by chance. There is hashgacha in which assures the preservation of the species, but there is no hashgacha with respect to the individual. And the Rambam here gives a mashal what would be if Aristotle's theory is correct. Once again, he gives a mashal for someone in a boat. The Rambam likes mashalim about people being saved from, or not being saved, from ships, as we'll see. He uses this mashal many times. We saw before that this might have personal meaning for the Rambam, having experienced it himself.
And his brother having
died in a shipwreck, correct. For instance, if a hurricane or a wind of less than hurricane force should blow, it would indubitably bring some leaves of this particular tree to fall, break a branch or another, topple a stone from a certain fence, raise up the dust so that it covers certain plants and causes its destruction, agitate waves in the water so that a ship that is there would founder, and so that all the people on board, or at least some of them, would be drowned. Consequently, according to them, there's no difference between the fall of a leaf and the fall of the stones on the one hand, and the drowning the excellent and superior men that were on board on the other. In other words, just like the Rambam says it's obvious that there's no hashgacha that when a wind blows, a particular leaf falls in a particular way. Well, if Aristotle's right, hu adin, there's no hashgacha like a ship full of tzaddikim would also sink. There's no difference between the two. There's no difference between man and animal or the like. Now, the Rambam writes that this position contradicts the Torah. First of all, because the Torah, as we noted last week, clearly takes for granted that there is hashgacha pratis. It frequently discusses how certain people were saved by Hashem, how Hashem interacted in their lives, how they davened and Hashem listened. All these things would obviously be impossible according to Aristotle. The third view is that of the Asherite sect. That was a Muslim school of thought that was founded at the beginning of the 10th century, and it had considerable influence, including on Jewish thinkers, and it was basically meant to combat the doctrine of the Methuselites. Well, them there, the fourth opinion. The Methuselites were a rationalist Muslim school of thought, and the Asherites were responding in a philosophical sense to their rationalism with a more religious approach. So This is what the Asherites say. They take the exact opposite extreme. They say that absolutely everything is the result of divine providence. For example, even the random movements of an inanimate object, when the wind blows, like he said before, and a tree and a leaf falls down from a tree, how it falls, which direction it falls, where it falls, all that is a result of divine will. In other words, according to the Asherites, the third school of thought, there is no such thing as nature. Now, in coming weeks, we'll have a chance to see that there are a number of Jewish thinkers who also say there's no such thing as nature. The Chazon Ish and Rav Dessler and earlier thinkers as well, maybe the Chovos HaVavos, we'll talk about that. But their view is nothing to do with this view, because the Asherites reject, based off of their theory, free will. Because everything is direct result of the divine will, then there's no such thing as free will, and that's obviously something that is a foundation of Jewish belief, as we'll see also in a couple of weeks. Moreover, the Asherites, because there's no freedom, were forced to reject divine justice, because after all, if people are suffering, and they're suffering for things that they really had no choice but to do, so that contradicts justice. And of course, that too is also against the Torah, Tzur Tamim Palo, Ki Chol D'Rachav Mishpat, Kel Amunah Ve'en Avel, Tzadik V'Yashar Hu. So that opinion is also rejected. The fourth opinion, and this is an opinion that we might actually think might be reasonable, but we'll see the Rambam rejects it as well, is the Methuselites. And they are also, as I mentioned, a Muslim school of thought from the 8th century, very rationalist approach. And they say that God directly controls all that happens in nature. So they have a very broad hashgacha, but they also accept free will. Now, that seems pretty reasonable, right? There's hashgacha pratis on everything, but we also have free will. So the Rambam rejects it. But why does the Rambam reject it? What's so bad about this? So the Rambam writes, incongruities. Now, this is the paragraph on the Earth source sheets from today, which is on page 2 we're looking at now, the top source on page 2. Again, there's more up here if anybody needs. Incongruities and contradictions follow necessarily also from this opinion. As far as incongruities, if some human individual is born with an infirmity without having sinned. So how does this view, how does this school of thought explain when somebody's born with a disease or the like that causes them suffering? So of course this is a problem, because it doesn't seem to be very fair. Why should they suffer? So what do the Methuselites say? They say, this is consequent upon his wisdom, and it is better for this individual to be thus than to be sound of body. Meaning to say, they say, kach gazra chachmaso, for some reason, this is of course for the best, and it's better for this person to live this life in which he's always experiencing suffering and pain, and we don't know why, but this is for the good of that person. And the Rambam thinks that this makes no sense. They have a similar answer with regard to the case in which an excellent man perishes. Again, how do you deal with the fact that sometimes tzaddikim die? Saying that this happens in order that his reward in the other world should become greater. Again, we saw last week that the Rambam doesn't like this theory. This is his understanding of a view in Chazal. When Chazal say, Yisurin Shel Ava, this is what the Rambam understands what it means. And the Rambam thinks that doesn't make sense. It's unfair. Finally, discussion with these reached a point at which they were asked, why is he just towards man and not just to what is other than man? In other words, what about animals? Right? It's very unfair when the lion tears apart the gazelle. Because of what sin has this particular animal been killed? Whereupon they assumed the burden of the following disgraceful answer. They had no choice but to say the following answer. This is better for it, namely the animal, so that God should compensate it in the other world. In other words, because they say everything is hashkacha, even with respect to animals, and there's justice even with respect to animals, so there has to be olam haban with respect to animals. And the Rambam, of course, thinks that this is totally unreasonable. First of all, it's unreasonable to maintain that everything is intended and nothing is random. It's irrational to think that a leaf fell in a particular way, or that animals suffer for a particular reason. We'll talk more about why that is. But partially it's because animals don't have free will with respect to moral matters, in which case the notion of reward and punishment is ridiculous. And second of all, as we'll also discuss later on in this man, hopefully, the notion of the afterlife of Olam Haba is totally ridiculous with respect to animals because they have no intellect and they can't connect to God in an intellectual way, which is what happens in Olam Haba. It also assumes, and this is something that we're going to have to see more about, appreciate in the Rambam, but from a philosophical perspective, the notion that everything that happens is miracles, or at least that miracles are happening all the time, all over the place, with respect to everything that happens, hashgacha, 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 there's no such thing as teva, is problematic for the Rambam from a philosophical perspective, and we'll have to elaborate upon that, upon why that is. But basically what the Rambam is going to be looking for, as we read now, the Torah's perspective, is a naturalistic approach, meaning to say it's not something in which there are miracles every single second, but at the same time is going to maintain free will and allow for justice. And that's basically what the Rambam is going to try to argue for. And this brings us to the fifth view, the view of the Torah. So that's over here, beginning with the theory. The theory of man's perfectly free will is one of the fundamental principles of the law, meaning of the Torah, of our teacher of Moshe, and those who follow the law. According to this principle, again, everybody see where we are? Second paragraph, page 2. According to this principle, man does what is in his power to do by his nature, his choice, and his will. And his action is not due to any faculty created for the purpose. All species of irrational animals likewise move by their own free will. This is the will of God. What he means to say, animals have free will not in a moral sense, but like an animal decides if he wants to pasture on this ground or in that ground or the like. This is the will of God. That is to say, it is due to the eternal divine will that all living beings should move freely, and that man should have the power to act according to his will or choice within the limits of his capacity. So it's Ratzon Hashem that a person has the freedom to make the choices that they're able to make. Against this principle, we hear, thank God, no opposition on the part of our nation. Right? Everybody agrees to the notion of Bechira Chashus. It's not really true. Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva writes about all the foolish people who deny Bechira, but that's something we can definitely accept. Another fundamental principle taught by the law of Moses is this. Wrong cannot be ascribed to God in any way whatsoever. All evils and afflictions, as well as all kinds of happiness of man, whether they concern one individual person or community, are distributed according to justice. So principle 2 we have to accept is justice. They are the result of strict judgment that admits no wrong whatever. Even when a person suffers pain in the consequence of a thorn having entered his hand, right, he's referring here to the Gemara probably that we quoted last time, although it is at once drawn out, it is a punishment that has been inflicted on him for sin, and the least pleasure he enjoys is a reward for some good action. Right? Tzadik v'yashar hu. However, the Rambam says, we are only ignorant of the working of that judgment. We can't understand how HaKadosh Baruch Hu is just, and why this is a punishment for this or a reward for that. That we don't know, but we understand and we accept that he is absolutely just. Okay. Then the Rambam goes ahead and presents that there is a difference, though, between man and animal. The Rambam introduces this paragraph by saying this is his own belief. In other words, he thinks it's consistent with the Torah, as we'll see in a moment, but it's not stated explicitly in the Torah. The previous two things that he said, namely the idea of Bechira Chafshis, as well as the idea of justice, are explicit in the Torah in many, many places. The distinction between hashgacha vis-a-vis people and animals is not explicit in the Torah, so he refers to it as his own belief. But he explains that it is not in contradiction with it. In fact, he writes that he's saying he arrived at this view through the study of Torah and not due to philosophical speculation. And that is basically, we'll read it in a second, that the Rambam writes that he accepts Aristotle's theory with respect to animals and inanimate objects, but with respect to people, he does not. So with respect to, you know, whether or not the lion is going to successfully catch the gazelle this time, or the gazelle will get out just in time from the lion's clutches, that is not in our hand. That is not, God does not actively control that. God created the laws of nature, and within the within nature, so the resolution to that conflict will be resolved. But there's no direct hashgacha, there's no hashgacha pratis with respect to animals and plants. And the Rambam writes, why did he come to this conclusion? What was the basis? So he writes, I have been, you see here, the third paragraph, page 2, I have been induced to accept this theory by the fact that I have not met in any of the prophetical works with a description of God's providence otherwise than in relation to human beings. In other words, whenever the Torah talks about Hashgacha, it always talks about Hashgacha with respect to people. The prophets even express their surprise that God should take notice of man. It's too little and too unimportant to be worthy of the attention of the Creator. How then should other living creatures be considered as proper objects of divine providence? When we look, he quotes Psukim, right? It's amazing the prophets say that Hashem even provides hashgacha for people. So, kavachomer, it would be absurd that it would apply to animals. Our opinion is not contradicted by scriptural passages like the following. He gives the food beast, right? He gives the beast its food. Many Psukim talk about Hashem gives food to all the animals. There are many similar sayings extant in the writings of our sages, but they do not imply anything that is contrary to my view. All these passages refer to the providence in relation to the species and not to providence in relation to individual animals. Right? So there's hashgacha klalis, like Aristotle said, as it were, with respect to animals, and that's what it means, no sein lebehe malach mao, but there's no hashgacha pratis. That this particular animal might starve and this particular animal might find plenty, there's no hashgacha in that respect. Okay. Now, parenthetically, it's interesting, but the Rambam explains that is why it's permissible to kill animals to eat their meat, right? If there was such a thing as hashgacha concerning animals, he thinks that would be wrong. I'll just read you this. I didn't include in your sheets. But since there is no hashgacha regarding animals, you could kill them. And then he says, what about tzar bali chayim? Maybe you would think that implies that there is hashgacha for animals. He says, no. But the object of this rule, meaning tzar bali chayim, is to make us perfect, that we should not assume cruel habits, that we should not uselessly cause pain to others, that on the contrary, we should prepare to show pity and mercy to all living creatures, except when necessity demands the contrary. Meaning to say, tzar bali chayim, which means unnecessary pain to animals, is to make us moral, kind people. It's not for the animals, it's really for us. Interestingly enough, this is the Ramban's perspective. The Ramban, in the Parsha Shiloh HaKein, thinks Rambam doesn't agree to this. But yeah, we're not there yet, so we can't talk about it. Good point. Okay, so back to Hashgacha. The Rambam and Ramban's, Ramban also, Parshas Noach, right? Seems to contradict Kiseitze, as you notice. But not for now, that's Ramban. So anyway, the point is that the relationship to animals is interesting, both in Rambam and Ramban, but fundamentally saying there's no hashgacha to animals, that's why they could be killed. And the truth is, when you read Rambam's presentation of his view, you get the impression that he sympathizes with Aristotle's hesitancy about providence. From a philosophical perspective, the notion of providence is actually quite extraordinary. Thus, as we noted, the prophets themselves were astounded by it. And Rambam's acceptance of Hashgacha is a reflection of the remarkable potential of what a human being is. As we'll see in a moment, it's precisely because of what a human being can accomplish, that a human being is a Tzelem Elokim, capable of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the most profound of ways, that there is Hashgacha klape human beings. And that's why, when it comes to animals who aren't capable of this spiritual perfection, memela, there is no ashkachan. In fact, the Rambam writes, when humans act as animals, when they do not actualize that potential that God has given to them, and they fail to connect to God, so a human that acts like an animal is treated like an animal and is not the subject of hashkacha pratis. And a human is only the subject of hashkacha pratis to the extent to which he actualizes that potential, that gift, the intellect, the neshama, as we'll see, that God has given to him. Now, ad kan, we've seen that the Rambam says there is such a thing as hashkacha, at least with respect to humans. Now, there are still a number of questions that we have to address. Some are philosophical, like, if it's true that human beings are the subject of hashkacha, and there's absolute schar va'onesh, so that would imply that the world is in fact full of miracles, in which God is always constantly intervening to reward and punish people. As we noted, that the Rambam finds this problematic on philosophical grounds. In addition, we still have to justify something that we see, namely, seemingly righteous and righteous individuals suffering unjustly. How do we explain that? Is the Rambam really going to say that all suffering is just and that everybody suffers due to sin? And there's no such thing as suffering, even the most horrible suffering, that's not due to sin? It's true from what we read last week. You might get that impression from the Rambam. But as we'll see shortly, the Rambam might not accept that. And in fact, that might be the central theme of the book of Iov, which we'll discuss in a moment, a book which the Rambam maintains is all about hashkacha. So, the Rambam seems to address these issues by making the following distinction. There is a distinction between the hashkacha that's experienced by those that are righteous and those that are average and those that are wicked. Now, the Rambam doesn't just want to say even that, because that too would be problematic. First of all, it would imply that with respect to the righteous, there's once again all these miracles going on all the time, right? They too are constantly experiencing miracles, which the Rambam finds problematic. And number two, the Rambam notes that even that's insufficient to answer the question of tzaddik v'ralo, because we do seem to find examples of tzaddikim suffering, which perhaps cannot be explained simply by the fact that they sinned. So, to answer this question, the Rambam explains, these two questions, that the Rambam explains that God watches over man by way of the intellect itself. So it's not the pshat that there are a bunch of little nisim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu protects the righteous. Rather, it is a natural consequence of the tzaddik's connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the Rambam, as we'll see, notes that to the extent that that connection is broken, there's hesach hadas, then the shmirah that the tzaddik experiences will also be interrupted. So let's take a look here at the Rambam. We'll read from where it says, V'ulam, again, middle of page 2. V'ulam ha'ashkacha ha'lokis lefi da'ati ulefi ma sh'ani ro'eh hi nimsheches achar ha'shefa ha'eloki. So it is a consequence upon the divine overflow. We'll try to define that in a moment. V'amin ha'sher nidbak bo ha'shefa ha'hu ha'sechli, and the species or the person that is in, or I guess the species that's endowed with that possibility, meaning humans, at sheshav bal seichel v'nigla lo kol ma shehu galui lebal ha'sechel hu asher hischabrai lav ha'ashkacha lokis v'sha'ara lo kol pe'ulosav al tzad hagmol v'ha'onesh. So the person that connects to God in this way, so for him, and the implication is for him alone, is it the case all that happens to him is al tzad hagmul v'haonesh, reward and punishment. Note he says here reward and punishment. We'll have to contrast that with chapter 51, where he might say something else. Amnam im tava svina. Okay, so how does that work? So does that just mean that someone who is constantly thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu will be miraculously saved? The Rambam adds a kenech, not exactly. Amnam im tava svina umasha betocha kemosha zachar v'nafal agag amisha bebay. So let's say the ship sinks or the roof collapses. Im haya b'mikra gamur. In other words, that was a natural happening. The ship sank because there was a storm or because it was poorly constructed. Lo haya biyas ha'anashim b'svina v'sheves ha'achayrim b'bayis b'mikra lefidato. In other words, the tzaddik's happening to go on the ship is not mikra lefidatenu. Aval biratzon eloki lefiadin b'mishpatav asher lo yagiu de'osenu liyidiyat sidram. In other words, if the tzaddik is about to board the ship, and this ship is doomed to sink because it is poorly constructed, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu will cause that this tzaddik will decide not to board the ship. Perhaps he'll notice that there's something wrong with the ship, and he will think, no, better wait for the next ship. So the ship sinking might be mikra, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu will protect the tzaddik from being subject to that mikra, but not necessarily through supernatural intervention, namely miraculously saving this unseaworthy ship, but rather allowing the tzaddik to realize that boarding this ship is not a good idea. And as the Rambam writes over here, all this takes place naturally due to the divine intellectual influence. Now, what does he mean by this divine flow? So the Rambam's saying that the idea is that when a person connects to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they're thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so that connection allows the overflow of Hashem's Shefa to cause them to understand and appreciate certain things. It's in a sense similar to the idea of Nevuah, or the flashes of lightning that the Rambam describes in his introduction, and that causes a person to understand things, including about the nature of Hashem or Hashkacha, or how to live his life. And that's how things work. Let's read on a little bit in the Rambam. That was from chapter 17. This is from chapter 18, the next text in Hebrew. V'achar shehu kein, yischaiv lefi ma shezacharnu beperka kodem, ki eze ish meishei b'nei adam, sheisig min ha-shafa ha-hu chelek yoser gadol, kefi ha-chanas ha-chomer shelo kefi hislam do. So memela, if a person has a greater shefa because he's trained himself to be better, or his naturally he is able to tap into it to a greater degree, naturally and necessarily it will be the case that he will experience greater hashkacha. Im hashkacha hinim shechas achar haseichel kemoshe zacharti, because as we noted, hashkacha is nimshach achar haseichel. Velo tia im kein hashkacha haelokis b'vnei adam kulam shavan. Then naturally, it won't be the same for all people. Aval ya yisron hashkacha lehem ki yisron shleimusam haenoshi zelzat. Rather, the hashkacha will correlate to the degree of perfection that they've achieved. Ulefi ze ha'iyun yischayev b'achreach shetia hasagaso b'neviyim atzuma me'od ulefi madrega sam b'nevuah. Naturally, then, for the prophets, it will be extraordinary hashkacha, and even within the prophets, depending on their degree of prophecy. V'tia hasagaso b'chasidim uvetovim kefi chasidusam v'yashrunam achar shashiur ha'hu mishafa ha'seichal ha'oki hu asher sam ha'davar b'fi ha'neviyim v'hu asher yashar Ma'aseihem atovim vishlim chachmos hachasidim v'meshiyedu. Notice here how he says and stresses this is not just through the intellectual achievements, but also ma'asim tovim. I will return to this point also when we read 351 in a minute. V'amnam hasichlim hamamrim kafima shechasru min hashefahu, to the extent that foolish people who don't connect to the divine are chaser this shefa. Inyanam nivze v'sudro b'seder shara ishe minei b'nei balichayim. So they're going to be like animals, because they're acting like animals. They're not taking advantage of that human capacity that they're capable of achieving. Nimshal k'behemos nidmu u'mipnei ze hayakal hargam. Okay, we can't talk about that. Anyway, so obviously that doesn't apply nowadays. Chazanish, among others, points out. Now, this brings us to Rambam's extraordinary revelation about Hashgacha that he describes in 351. Rambam, you know, says he himself experienced Hashgacha, and when he thought about Hashgacha, he came to this amazing insight, a Chiddush Atzum. We'll figure out what's this Chiddush Atzum, because it seems like it's saying the same thing as he said already, but we'll elaborate on that as well. First, to appreciate the context of 351, I know there are a lot of questions. Don't worry. We're not going to understand any of this in the end. I don't either. Nah. We'll try our best, but let's try to read a little more, get a little more context, and then to the extent that we can understand anything, we'll do our best. So the context of 351 is really 351 is a very important parak in the Rambam, a lot of important yesodos. After describing different types of people and the importance of connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu intellectually, the Rambam goes ahead and he gives a shtickle musar shmuz. He tells us a plan by which we can learn, train ourselves to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this way constantly. Take a look at in page 3 where you see the boxes. I'm just going to read the English, go a little quicker, it's late. The intellect that emanates from God onto us is the link that joins us to God. You have it in your power to strengthen that bond, if you choose to do so, or weaken it gradually until it breaks, if you prefer this. Right? So you could do this. This is in all of our potential. If you become strong, only when you employ it in the love of God and seek that love, it will be weakened when you direct your thoughts to other things. Moreover, right? Sometimes we're davening and learning and we're connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu intellectually, and sometimes we're busy going grocery shopping and the like, and we're not. You must know that even if you were the wisest man in respect to the true knowledge of God, you break your bond between you and God whenever you turn your thoughts entirely to the necessary food or any necessary business. So if you go ahead and you start taking care of your business, you have to go to the DMV to renew your driver's license, and while you're waiting in line, so naturally you're not going to be thinking about God. At that time, you are not with God, and He is not with you, for that relation between you and Him is interrupted in those moments. Then the Rambam writes that the purpose of all practices of the worship, such as reading the Torah and performing other mitzvos, have only the end of training you to occupy yourself with his mitzvos rather than with matters of the world. So Rambam tells us that basically, if you follow Torah and you observe mitzvos and the like properly, this will train you and bring you to a point where you're connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to the extent possible. And note here that the Rambam does stress the value of physical mitzvos in this context. And he notes, by the way, this is also an important point, this is the next citation you have here on page 3, that this is true when you perform mitzvos thoughtfully, not just doing mitzvos anashim ilumada, right? He writes, in all cases in which perform a mitzvah merely with your limbs, as if you were digging a hole in the ground or hewing wood in the forest, without reflecting upon either the meaning of that action or upon him whom the commandment precedes, or upon the end of the action, you should not think you have achieved the end. In other words, if you do mitzvot without any thought, you will not be achieving the full purpose and goal of the mitzvos. We'll talk about this more later on in this Zman Bezus Hashem. We talk about Tamei Mitzvos and the like. So then the Rambam offers practical guidance regarding the form of training that you should do in order to achieve this end. The first step, he says, is to focus on HaKadosh Baruch Hu when you're saying Shema. In other words, follow the things when you say Shema, first brach of Shmona Esrei, and the like. And then when you get better at that, so all of your davening should be with Kavana. And then all of that time you'll be connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then whenever you learn Torah or hear Torah also, you will be constantly directed, the whole of you and your thought, towards reflection upon that which you're listening and reading. And these times of contemplation will expand and grow ever larger as you get better and better in this training, so that when you say brachos, you're going to be thinking of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And perhaps even when you then eat that food, because you've said that bracha, you'll be thinking of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what brachos do. They help bring HaKadosh Baruch Hu into even the mundane aspects of our life and allow us to be mischaber to HaKadosh Baruch Hu during these times. And then he writes the next paragraph you have on page 3, if while performing these acts of worship you are free from distraction and not engaged in thinking upon any of the things pertaining to this world. Right? We all know that's not so easy. It's very easy to space out even during Shmona Esrei, Kal Vachomer during other things. But anyway, after this has been achieved, to occupy your thought with the things necessary for you or your superfluous in your life and in general with worldly things while you eat or drink or bathe or talk with your wife or your small children or while you talk with the common people or rung among people. Thus, I provided you with many and long stretches of time which you can think all that needs thinking regarding property governance of household and welfare of the body. Meaning, say like this, most people, even if they achieve this, which as we know isn't so easy, so the truth is that there are going to be long stretches in their life in which they're not thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, because they're going to be involved in paying their taxes or going to work and the like. So you could go ahead and try to minimize these times and learn in Kolel and spend lots of time thinking only of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but still there'll be moments of interruption. Then the Rambam says, in this magnificent flash of apprehension, he discovered something marvelous. A most extraordinary speculation, again, bottom of page 3 now, has occurred to me just now, through which doubts may be dispelled and divine secrets revealed. We have already explained in the chapters concerning Hashgacha, that's the ones we read already, 317, 318, that Hashgacha watches over everyone endowed with intellect proportionally to the measure of his intellect. Thus, Providence always watches over an individual endowed with perfect apprehension, whose intellect never ceases from being occupied with God. On the other hand, an individual endowed with perfect apprehension, whose thought sometimes, for a certain time, is emptied of God, is watched over by Providence only during those times when he thinks of God. Providence withdraws from him during the time when he's occupied with something else. However, its withdrawal is not like the withdrawal from those who have never had intellectual cognition, but in his case, that providence merely decreases because that man of perfect apprehension, while being occupied, no intellect in actu, but the perfect man is at such times only apprehending potentially and not close to actuality, right? Because Lamaisa, he has Hasach Hadas when he's getting his driver's license. At such times, he is like a skilled scribe at the time when he's not writing. Hence, it seems to me that all the prophets are excellent or imperfect men whom one of the evils of this world befell. Had this evil happened to them during such a time of distraction, the greatness of the calamity being proportioned to the duration of the period of distraction or to the vileness of the matter which he is occupied. So what happened? What happened here is that if something bad happened to a good person, it happened to them while they had Hesach Hadas from thinking of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right? But, the Rambam says, there are extraordinary, extraordinary, extraordinary people. People like the Avos, like Moshe Rabbeinu, people who never have Hesach Hadas at all from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Even while they're engaged in the mundane, they are thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I once went with a friend of mine who's a big tzaddik and talmid chacham, and we had to go to a kiddush. And we sat down at this kiddush because we are invited to sit down, and the fellow making the kiddush was talking to us about this, that, and the other thing. And this friend of mine was talking to him about this, that, and the other thing. And then we left, and he told me, I want to tell you the following seven chidushin that I came up while talking to this other person. I wasn't actually paying any attention to him, and I came up with the following seven chidushin, and he rattled off the chidushin. So I don't know. That's the type of thing that the Rambam was talking about, right? Even if you're engaged in the mundane, but you're not really engaged in the mundane, you really have no hesach hadas, and such a person, so no evil will ever befall him. Because when you're thinking about a Kodesh Baruch Hu, nothing bad could happen to you. An interesting point here, he sounds like it's absolute protection. This is very similar to the school of the Nefesh HaChaim, right? Of thinking about Eino Malvado, that nothing bad could happen to you. The Rambam may or less says the same. There are a lot of parallels between Rambam and the Nefesh HaChaim, but for another time. So the Rambam deals with that, actually. But we're not going to see that now. Okay, good. Now, so what do we do? So the Rambam elsewhere talks about there are in suffering in general, and why there is suffering in chapter 12. The Rambam there delineates three types of evils. Number one, evil caused by nature. Number two, evil that people bring upon each other, like by fighting or war or cheating. And number three, personal evil, things that you bring upon yourself. The first type of evil, the Rambam says, is a natural result of our being material beings. And to the extent that we could make ourselves more spiritual, so as we've seen, we'll be protected from that first type of evil. The second type of evil, so by following the Torah, or the truth is any laws, if it's a just legal system, will prevent people from harming each other. And certainly by following the Torah and acting properly, you'll be protected from evil that happens to, that you bring upon yourself. Now, there's one more major section of the Rambam that where he deals with Hashgacha. This is in his discussion of the book of Iyov. And the truth is, it's this discussion where I think things get really tricky. It's over here in his discussion. Until now, I think most of everything we've seen in the Rambam really is coherent, and it works together, and it doesn't contradict each other. The problem emerges when we read chapter 323, which discusses the story of Iyov. The problem is that we're out of time. So this is what we're going to do. I guess we'll at least the first half of next year also discuss Rambam's view. And if you didn't already have a chance to read what we've read today, make sure you look at it, as well as read 323, his interpretation of the book of Iyov. That will open up a number of problems, and we'll make a suggestion next week. So let me take the questions that are shayach to this week's stuff, and we'll continue with this next week, Bezras Hashem. After Rambam, we'll do the position of the Ramban, Bezras Hashem, which also has its share of contradictions, and we'll have a mahalich in that as well. And then we'll try to think of some, consider some of the other thinkers and the like. Yeah, so questions.
He said in the Rambam, the concept of divine justice means that if something bad can happen to someone, so the Kodesh will either prevent it happening or allow it to happen, even if it's a violation of heaven. How does, so someone's not thinking about the Kodesh.
Right, so what you're saying is the following. It would seem from the Rambam that if you aren't thinking of Hashem, you're subject to nature. And if you're subject to nature, then bad things could happen to you, even if they're not deserved. And if so, so then doesn't that contradict divine justice? So you'll have to take one of two approaches. One is that if something unjust is going to happen through nature, then God intervenes and prevents it. That's a possibility we mentioned last time. The other possibility, which I think is more likely, and we'll talk about this more next time, is that no, that is not a violation of divine justice because God didn't do it. You did it to yourself by allowing yourself to be subject to nature. Meaning to say, what Rambam said is absolutely objectionable from a perspective of justice is to say that God will bring upon a person something that's unjust. The question is, when that happens due to nature, is that necessarily unjust? And the Rambam might be saying no. We'll elaborate on that next time. Yes?
I remember us saying that the Rambam prophecies is achieved after a person achieves a certain level of intellectual perfection and God intervenes.
Yes.
But why does God have to, why is it to be like a secondary intervention of God?
It's a very interesting question, and there's actually a lot of discussion what the Rambam means by that. The Rambam does think that prophecy is natural, a natural progression of intellectual perfection, like you've said. But the Rambam also does write that, like Ke'en the Mesil Sesharim, it's Tchilaso Avoda Vesofo Matana. And that last threshold, which allows for the type of connection between God and man that takes place through prophecy, does in fact require an act of hashkacha. That last step is not entirely natural. It's only possible when a person has perfected himself intellectually, but to achieve that last step does require an act of intervention. And that is the nature, the nace, as it were, of prophecy. Yes?
Is everyone aware of no hashgacha prophecies by animals?
Yeah.
But I imagine that if it's related to... Like,
yeah, in Achanami. Yeah, in other words, a shur is not going to... If a person is gored by an ox, so that would be subject to hashgacha.
But
that's not... No.
No,
we don't care about the animal's justice because animal doesn't have das. It doesn't have seichel. There's no moral free will. So there's no issue of justice with respect to the animal. So with respect to the human, it is. So to the extent that animals and humans interact with each other, so then hashgacha shayach, as he explained.
So an animal's suffering is not relevant.
It's not relevant because there an animal doesn't have free will, can't make good choices, can't make bad choices. Yeah.
Doesn't the word say the dog got rewarded for not barking?
The Rambam will have to understand what that means, but you know the Pashup shot is that the Rambam probably will say that that's not meant so literally. After all, it doesn't make any sense, right? The dogs didn't make a choice about not barking, did they? So if they didn't, then why should they be rewarded?
They wouldn't agree they didn't make a choice to do that.
That's the Pashup shot. Pashup shot is that animals don't have free will. That's uniquely human. At least this type of free will, moral free will. And again, there are many statements in Chazal about animals. The Rambam elsewhere writes that we can't take those so literally. And they're teaching us a very important lesson of HaKadosh Baruch Hu rewarding those who do what's right and the like, and Akas HaTov and the like. But it's not that the animals freely chose to do it. And in fact, that's the implication of the Pesukim, that it was a nace. Yeah.
So according to the Rambam, a prick in the pocket would be considered a shara.
The Rambam says that, at least for the right person.
And then, one question. How do we term what defines more a shara or less a shara?
The Rambam seems to say that less hashgacha means that you're subject to nature. Now, being subject to nature could produce good results or bad results. But it means being subject to nature, to the whims of nature, the randomness of nature. Yeah?
So when the Rambam talks about the kind of divine intellectual assistance, like the person will know not to get on the boat or something mm-hmm. like that, and like the Rambam says he can't really explain how like that doesn't impinge on the person's free will, is that the fact that would still count as free will, like, function of the fact that the person's not aware that this thought is somehow a result of a shift?
Probably. Meaning to say, free will means you have the ability to do what's right and what's wrong. Now, one person might realize, HaKadosh Baruch Hu might cause them to realize that doing a particular act is a good idea or a bad idea. He might cause them to see or notice something or the like. And then they have the freedom of choice. So the tzaddik still has the choice whether or not he's going to board the ship, right? Hashem helps him discover or recognize that this ship is like, you know, looks like it's not, might not be in the best shape. Okay, now what's he going to do with that information? It's his freedom to choose how to react to that awareness.
Yeah, but what about, let's say...
And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I mean, that happens all the time, right? Yeah. Like, sometimes you'll realize something and I won't realize something. That's not, just because I'm not aware of something, or I don't figure something out, that doesn't mean my free will is in some way limited.
But assuming there was a case, let's say, where there's no rational way for any person, like a malfunction of a plane, there's no way anyone would have known that beforehand, and that tzaddik was on the plane, like, would there be any way to explain?
There's no lack of freedom. Just like there's no, it doesn't in any way impinge on freedom. Just like you wouldn't say it impinges on freedom for Hashem to miraculously save the airplane such that the tzaddik will not be hurt. Right, so the airplane runs out of gas in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Hashem doesn't want the tzaddik to drown, so he miraculously causes the airplane to fly with no fuel all the way to London.
That's
not a lack of hashgacha. It's not a lack of free will. So too, it shouldn't be a lack of free will if Hashem somehow or another causes the tzaddik to become aware that it's not a good idea, or something else that causes the tzaddik not to board.
Somehow in that case, it's still be the tzaddik's choice, just seems that somehow in that case would be more like constructed and artificial, and there's no way that anyone, whatever. I guess it doesn't really make a difference. It's still his choice, this is no way that the person would ever come to that decision if not
right.
for the fact.
I think that's true, and that. All right. So I'll pick up with this next week. Be'ezus Hashem.